We are here today for an official account of what you saw on the night of July 2nd, 2006. Today is July 3rd, 2006, so let the record show that these recollections are recent and thus less likely to be subject to manipulation. We will be using a memory sharing working, a technique with which Merlin is particularly adept. Sir, what frequency do you need from me?
65.4 megahertz.
Before we begin, can you describe the technique you'll be using?
Yes. This working is mental magic involving a minor alteration of consciousness in which we temporarily share a so-called mind's eye. I will supply our shared mind's eye with the memory of the incident, and you will describe, for the record, an account of what you see. You will form the connection at 65.4 megahertz with your handheld whistle, and I will maintain it at 63.2 megahertz as you describe the images using a dental implant.
Thank you. Shall I begin? I am in an office, looking out a window. It's dark outside, but I recognize a couple of the buildings from their lights. City Hall, I know it from the pillars. If I had to guess, I'd say I'm in the Camel, in the Cordis Center for Advanced Magical Innovation and Learning, facing south. There's a glass of whiskey on the table in front of me, on top of a stack of old books. There's a lot of books, stacked everywhere, actually. Somebody's knocking. I turn around and whistle, flicking my fingers. The doors open, and the man runs in. He's dressed in military sweats, the kind we sleep in. He's out of breath, too out of breath to talk. He gestures for Merlin to follow him, and Merlin does. They go to the elevator and down to the fifth floor. Everybody at the Camel calls it the Chosen Floor, because that's where the Chosen One lives and where his army trains. Almost nobody's allowed on that floor, so I've never seen it before myself. This fellow has to scan his badge before the elevator will move. Elevator opens to an empty hallway. Only it feels off somehow. Sort of stuffy, like the way the air feels when there's way too many people in one place, except here there's not a soul in sight. I'm on night patrols. I went up, heard something. The soldiers recovered enough of his breath to explain the situation. Saw, didn't know who else to call. You did the right thing, I say. Merlin says, I mean. What's happened? The army's gone, he says. They reach the end of the hallway, where there's two doors with crash bars on them. Above them is a sign that says training area. He lets Merlin open them. The floor is squishy, like a gymnasium, rubbery too, so it squeaks under his shoes. But it's dark in there. Only the emergency lights are on, so all I can see is dark shapes here and there, little bumps on the floor. It maybe looks like someone left a bunch of mats out, forgot to put them away. Merlin whistles, waves his siphon hand. All the lights go on at once. They're so bright he shields his eyes for a second, and I wish he'd kept shielding them. They're all lying there in their training clothes, white shirts and gray pants. They all fell in different positions, some flat on their backs, some flat on their faces, some on their sides, their arms under them, their legs twisted like they were running and tripped before dying. Their eyes are open. Nobody tells you that sometimes. People die with their eyes open. Somebody has to shut them, only no one has here. So there are just these stares coming at me from all sides, empty stares, slack mouths too, open, drooling. God, it's... There's one alive, coming to his feet, right in the middle of the room. Not a military man, dressed in civvy clothes. Tall, really tall. The kind of guy you wouldn't start a fight with. He sees us, and I can't get a good look at his face because his hair's falling in front of it, and then he lifts his hand, and there's sound and light. It hurts. God, so loud. I can't help but stagger back and shield my head.
It's over in a second, though, and I blink hard to get my vision back, but it takes a minute for the splotches to disappear. The soldier who brought me here is lying on the ground now, and I reach for him, shake his shoulder. He doesn't move. He doesn't move. He's dead, and the tall man is gone, and I'm alone with the dead. Who was he? Do you know?
Sybil said there would be another, a dark one who could end the world just as the chosen one could save it. I think we have finally met him.
Chapter 22. An hour later, Esther and Sloane stuffed themselves into a taxi with Kyros and a fellow soldier, a buxom woman named Edda. Sloane looked through the raindrops at the merchandise mart, wide and squat, lit from beneath. She almost, in the moments before she remembered where she was, felt like she was at home. In the car with Matt, on their way to a restaurant where they would sit in the back, in a booth, so no one could see their faces. They would have a steak, a glass of wine, tell each other stories they had both lived through already. That time they went to an old farmhouse where they thought the Dark One was staying, and found only an old lady with rollers in her hair and a shotgun on her hip. That time they pranked Bert with sugar in the salt shaker, and he pretended he liked the taste so he wouldn't give them the satisfaction. That time. "Matt's gonna be pissed," Esther said. "We left a note," Sloane replied. "Yeah, I'm sure that will make it all better. Just blame it on me. He already hates me." "Yeah," Esther sighed and leaned back. "You made sure of that, didn't you?" The cab was the size of a small boat, boxy, with a hood ornament in the shape of a discus. It looked like a flying saucer to Sloane. But Kyros had struck up a conversation about college shot put front runners with the driver as soon as he sat down. Genetrix had, apparently, experienced a resurgence of interest in track and field in the last 10 years. It had eclipsed baseball. "So there's only one baseball team here?" Sloane couldn't get over it. "What do they call them, the Cub Sox?" "Chicago Cornhuskers," Edda said. "Cornhuskers?" Sloane couldn't imagine the city without a crosstown rivalry, let alone the city rallying behind the Cornhusker as a mascot. "Sloane, you don't even like baseball," Esther said. "Living in Chicago means liking baseball by proxy," Sloane said. "We need to come up with a plan," Esther sounded impatient. "We can't just show up on the guy's doorstep and tell him we're from—" She lowered her voice, checking the rearview mirror to make sure the driver was still talking discus with Kyros. "A parallel dimension." They coasted down Lakeshore Drive. Lake Michigan was the color of steel and restless, crashing hard against the wall that held it back from the road. Esther drummed her fingers on her knee. Her fingernails had been manicured at Albie's funeral, but the paint was flaking off now. "We could call it a military thing," Sloane said, glancing at the badge of the Army of Flickering on Edda's jacket. "Say it's top secret or something." Esther rolled her eyes. "Sure, that doesn't sound at all absurd." "Don't you know this man?" Edda chimed in. "Make your reason personal rather than official." "We know him and we don't," Sloane said. "But I guess we could try to use information we have about him from before the likely point of divergence between universes. So, before 1969. "He got married when he was 18, Esther said. "Had an older brother who drowned when he was 16, born in Idaho." They went over everything they could remember from Bert's early life as the taxi passed the Museum of Science and Industry. Green dome and stately columns standing on pristine grounds, the same as it was on Earth. Beyond it were sprawling red brick buildings with cracked sidewalks in front of them. Long, low municipal buildings with glass block windows. Trees with bare branches that twisted among the power lines. All familiar sights. But every so often they passed something she would never have seen at home. A picket line outside a siphon retailer with people carrying signs that said, "Magic for all, and Abraxas, enemy of the poor. And even, my mom sold a kidney to get an Abraxas siphon. A fast food restaurant with a drive-thru that appeared to be a Howard Johnson's, long defunct in her world. A high school called the Timuel Black School for Magic Theory and Practice. They turned off 57th Street onto a side street packed with houses. And the taxi pulled up next to an old craftsman home with the numbers 5730 painted above the front door. Esther and Sloane both stared at it while Kyros paid the driver with what appeared to be two $20 coins. Sloane had noticed people jingling as they walked or wearing little pouches hanging from their belts, but she hadn't connected them to currency before. They got out of the car, and the taxi pulled away from the curb. Sloane stared up at the old house, which was gray with white trim, the paint peeling, the lawn dull green and dusted with frost. "You guys had better stay out here," Esther said to Kyros and Etta. Kyros looked dubious. "If something bad happens, I'll let out a blood-curdling scream and you can come running. How's that?" Sloane said. "He's just an old guy," Esther said more reassuringly. "Fine," Kyros said. A shiver coursed through Sloane, and she forced herself to follow Esther down the front walk. A small collection of lawn gnomes stood around one of the stone planters, each of them wearing a red hat. "So you're his niece through his wife's sister," Esther said. "I'm 90% sure her name was Shauna." "That or something Polish neither of us can pronounce," Sloane replied, and they were at the door. "I have a niece your age," Bert had said to her once. "Haven't seen her in years." She had a clear memory of Bert getting out of his Honda Accord outside her house wearing an ill-fitting suit. Gray slacks, black shoes, a blue tie. His hair short, but not too short. Neither blonde nor brown, exactly. His eyes some middling shade of hazel. He had been so regular looking that she could barely describe him after he left. The only thing that had been distinct about him was that one of his eyes watered, and he dabbed at it with a folded handkerchief every few minutes. Evan Kowalczyk of Genetrix had a handkerchief pressed to his eye when he opened his door. "Can I help you?" he said, and Sloane's throat tightened. She couldn't speak. His voice was the same, just a little monotone. "Sorry to bother you," Esther said, jabbing Sloane hard in the side with her elbow. "Oh, yeah." Sloane cleared her throat. "I'm your wife's sister's daughter. Your niece, Shauna." "Shauna." He scratched behind one ear with one hand while stuffing his handkerchief in his pocket with the other. "It's been a while, hasn't it? Since you were maybe 11. 12, I think," Sloane said, because it felt natural. "I was just visiting the city, looking at schools, grad schools. Esther is helping me decide, and I remembered that you lived here, so..." "So we're just stopping by for a visit," Esther said, "if you're not busy." Evan was quiet for a moment, then said, "I have time for a cup of coffee if you'd like." "Perfect," Esther smiled. "Yes," Sloane said. "Coffee. Sounds good." Esther gave her a look that said, as clearly as if she'd spoken the words out loud, "Why are you acting like a robot?" He stepped away from the door, letting them inside. The foyer was cramped, only large enough to accommodate all three of them if they huddled together. They followed the creak of Evan's, footsteps across the dark wood floor and into the living room. A fire crackled in the fireplace, and a record spun on a nearby turntable. The strumming guitar and the high, tight voice of Neil Young's Harvest Moon. Sloane remembered getting into Bert's beige Honda Accord, the kind with the headlights that popped up out of the hood of the car when you turned them on, so he could drive her to the training facility to meet the other chosen ones. She had asked about music, and he had directed her to the glove compartment, where three Neil Young CDs, two Neil Diamonds, and a Phil Collins awaited her. "Could you be a more boring white dude?" she had asked him. She looked at Esther, whose face had gone slack, staring at the turning record. "Not sure where you got your height," Evan said to her, frowning. "Neither are we," Sloane said. She was straining to remember something, anything about Bert's sister-in-law, her supposed mother. "Some have suggested a milkman's baby situation, but..." "But you've got your dad's eyes," Evan supplied. "I'll get the coffee." Sloane had never been more grateful for having blue eyes in her entire life. She suppressed a hysterical giggle and turned toward the bookcase that stood next to the fireplace. The top shelf was packed with old novels. Moby Dick, White Fang, The Sound and the Fury, Catcher in the Rye. Like the entire syllabus for an intro to American literature class. Next to them was For the Living to the Dead, with Lee on the spine. When she slipped it out to see the cover, she read the name Harper Lee. The next shelf down was even more interesting. Monsters and Madness in Russian Folklore, Mythical Objects of Ancient Greece and Rome, The Ark of the Covenant, Fact or Fiction. "Were you studying to be an archaeologist?" Sloane called out to the kitchen where the coffee machine was groaning. "No," Evan called back. "Just a hobby. Lost its charm when magic became a reality." "Why?" Sloane turned to face him as he came back into the living room, her hand still hovering over the Russian folklore text. "No mystery left in anything, I suppose," Evan said. He was carrying the coffee pot in one hand and three mugs, his fingers through the handles with the other. He set all of them down on the coffee table on top of a book about castles, its dust jacket marked with rings from old cups. "What do you do, Mr. Kowalczyk?" Esther asked. "I work for the post office," he said, sitting down. "Don't you remember, Shauna? You sent me letters for Santa Claus when you were a child." Sloane smiled. "That's right. I thought you knew his address." Evan smiled back. "It's strange for a child to understand that it's helpful to be well-connected." Sloane moved to the pictures arranged on the mantel. There Bert had lost his wife in a mysterious incident. He had never been specific. That had later motivated him to join Eris in search of explanations. "I have never seen this picture of Anna," she said, picking up one of the frames. In the photograph, a young Evan Kowalczyk sat beside a plump woman, Anna Kowalczyk. Her hair tied up in a scarf and a pile of knitting on her lap. The picture of domesticity. "Ah, you wouldn't have. I was never very good at sending your mother copies." Evan's mouth pressed into a line, "or staying in touch." "It's a two-way street," Sloane said, hoping it was true. "How did she die?" Esther said. "You don't know?" Evan raised an eyebrow. "She was killed by the resurrectionist." Esther's and Sloane's eyes met. Sloane thought of the rubble of the drain site, a tomb of bodies and memories that would never be recovered. "How is your mother doing?" Evan asked her. "I know the anniversary was always hard for her." "Oh, she's all right," Sloane shrugged. "Dad's driving her crazy as usual." It had seemed like a safe comment in her head. But it came out sounding wrong, like a dissonant chord. Evan froze with his cup of coffee on his lap, his eyes on her. Sloane didn't dare to look away. "I mean," Sloane began. "Pete's been dead for 10 years. Evan set the coffee down on the table, his hand trembling. "You're not Shauna, are you?" He had gone rigid. Sloane felt her heartbeat all through her body, chest, fingers, throat, cheeks. "Shit," Esther said. "No," Sloane said. "I'm not." "Who are you?" Evan stood and stepped toward her. She stumbled back toward the front door, Esther was on her feet too, inching out of the living room. "Someone who knows what you could have been," Sloane said coldly. "There are plenty of mysteries left in the world, Evan." "Who are you?" Evan demanded again. "How do you know me?" Her eyes burned suddenly, like she might cry. Violence flared inside her, so similar to the burn of magic in her chest that she worried she would cause another gale like the one in the Hall of Summons that had shattered the Oculus window. She raised her voice. "The Resurrectionist killed your wife, and here you are delivering mail, living in your dead aunt's house like there's nothing to avenge." "How do you know whose house this is?" Evan's face had gone white. He blinked a stray tear down his cheek, forgetting to dab it away with his handkerchief. "How do you know anything about me?" "She has some latent clairvoyant abilities," Esther said, grabbing Sloane's arm. "She's also kind of an asshole. So sorry." "Get out," Evan said. "How can you be so—" Sloane started, but Esther was dragging her toward the front door. Sloane gave in to Esther's grip, letting herself be wrestled outside and down the steps to the sidewalk. She heard the door slamming, the lock sliding into place. Esther said something to Kyros and Etta, who were still waiting for them by the curb, but Sloane couldn't make out the words. She sat on the concrete and tried to breathe. Esther's hand was on her back, steady and warm. The sun was setting, and with it came the brutal wind coming off the lake, like daggers on her skin. They all stayed still for a long time, until Sloane's ears burned from the cold and Esther was shivering. After a while, Sloane said to Esther, "I wouldn't read those FOIA documents if I were you. It's not a BERT you'd want to know. So why did you read them?" Sloane shrugged and tilted her head back to look at the sky. The moon was rising behind the clouds. "More information is better, right?" She laughed. "Fuck." "Fuck," Esther agreed. "Want to get a drink somewhere?" "Yeah," Sloane said. And she let Esther help her to her feet and hook her elbow around Sloane's. "I know a place." Esther laughed, her crisp voice echoing down the empty street. Etta was standing on the corner of the street, her siphon hand raised and shining with ethereal light, hailing a taxi. "We're in an alternate universe," Esther said. "How do you know a place?" Sloane managed a smile. Chapter 23. They pulled up to the tankard, which didn't have a real sign. Just an old beer mug rendered in pink neon shining through the front window. Inside, it looked like a pub. Wood paneling everywhere, sticky but warm. Sloane raised an eyebrow at Esther as they walked in. The man sitting on a stool by the door was uninterested in their IDs. Sloane ran both hands through her hair to push it away from her face as she scanned the place for mocks. "Looks like a movie set," Esther said with a snort. She was right. The dark alcoves, the stone walls, the tables with candles burning on top of them. It was a scene from a fantasy movie or a place in a theme park. Except here, the magical effects were real. A lemon wedge floating over a gin and tonic, squeezing every time a woman took a sip. A martini with a bouncing, glowing olive. A glass of flaming whiskey whose fire didn't burn out when a man drank from it. Esther found a table in the back where they could all huddle together on low wooden benches, and Sloane went to the bar. The bartender wasn't dressed like the people in the Camel, that much was certain. Her clothes were tight, for one thing, and ripped every which way, artful tatters. Her nose was pierced horizontally with a metal rod that expanded when her nostrils flared. "Hi," Sloane said when the bartender came closer. "I'm looking for Mox." "Mox, huh?" the woman said. "Who are you?" "Sloane," she said. He told me I might find him here. I'll see if he's around. Can I also... But the woman was already gone. Order a drink? No? Okay. Sloane walked back to the table where Esther and Kyros were talking. So they follow me, which means every time I put up a video or a picture, it shows up in their feed. Feed? Yeah, like a big list of all the people they follow mashed together. And following someone just means you want to see videos of them talking. Yes. Why not just talk to the people around you? An excellent question, Sloane said, sliding into a chair. Because that's harder, Esther said, laughing. You have to do the whole social rigmarole. But on social media, you can be at home in your underwear and still feel like you have a social life. Esther was wearing Barbie pink lipstick and the standard siphon that Sloane had struggled with earlier that afternoon. It wasn't decorative enough for Esther. It was at odds with the pale yellow swirl of fabric around her face, which dissolved into a diamond-patterned dress that tapered to her ankles. I'm not sure I'd want antisocial naked people to watch videos of me, Kyros said. Sloane glanced at Etta. She was scanning the bar. Her siphon was rudimentary, like the one Esther wore on her hand, but hers was on her ear, giving her a lopsided appearance. She saw Sloane looking at it and arched an eyebrow. What? Do I have something on my face? No, Sloane said. Just not sure what the ear ones do. Enhanced hearing, Etta said. Distant sounds. Sounds too quiet for the human ear. Some people use them to interpret a person's tone better, but I'm no good at that. Sloane saw him then, ducking under the low doorframe behind the bar. His dark, wavy hair pulled back into a low knot. His eyes finding hers right away, as if drawn by magnetism. Hey, she said when he was close enough to hear her. Told you I'd escape. Mox was so tall that when he sank into a crouch beside her stool, he was almost at eye level. Welcome. I'm Esther. This is Kyros and Etta, Esther said, sticking out her hand for Mox to shake. Heard you helped my girl out of a jam. Unrealist snare, Mox said. Unrealists, Etta snorted. Bunch of pretentious art students. They can be brilliant, though, Mox said. Even the snare is an advanced working. Likely requires an assembly of at least 5 people with a high level of dissonance. Hard to maintain. Just because something is difficult, Etta said, doesn't mean it's worth doing. If we're going to talk about this, I'll need a drink, Kyros said, or 7. Right. Mox stood. What does everybody want? I want that thing with the glowing olive, Esther said. The genie martini, Mox said. A fine choice. Kyros and Etta both ordered beers that were obviously familiar to them. Mox looked at Sloane. I will go up there, she said. I want to look at what you've got. Sure you do, Esther said, and Sloane glared at her. She was glad to step away from the table and away from Esther's assessing stare. Mox slipped behind the bar, and Sloane leaned against it from the other side, making a show of squinting at the bottles lined up behind him. She raised an eyebrow when Mox grabbed a sheet of paper and dragged it over. On it were written the ingredients for the genie martini. Bad memory, he said. Forgot how to work the olive. That sounds like a euphemism, she said. He laughed and grabbed the jar of olives. Sloane watched with interest as he scooped one out with a spoon and put it in the bottom of the shaker. He covered it with his siphon hand, and she heard his low hum, much deeper than she was expecting. A wet bounce came from the shaker, and it shivered, with just his siphon hand keeping it still. He hummed again, this time higher, and when he pulled his fingers away from the shaker top, just a little, the olive was glowing blue. It bounced up, almost escaping, so he covered the top again. "I bet a lot of things get smashed when you guys figure out new recipes," she said. "Do you serve anything that doesn't bounce, float, or continuously burn?" "I could make you an OFOF, old-fashioned, old-fashioned," Mox said. "Sounds good," she said. "Still no siphon for you?" he said, nodding at her bare hands. He scooped some ice into the shaker, careful to cover it until the last second so the ice could pin the olive to the bottom. He poured some gin and vermouth on top of it, at which point the olive had wriggled free of its icy prison. He covered the top and let the olive do the shaking. "For all you know, I could have one on my right breast right now," she said. "How do you get that thing to settle down enough for someone to drink it?" "If you were rich enough and powerful to have a chest siphon, you would be cutting holes in your clothing to show it off," he said with a laugh. "And it's a dwindler, this working. All it needs is time." She tried not to give him a blank look, but she wasn't entirely sure she managed it. "Maybe I'm not showy about my siphons," she said.
"It's not a character assessment, it's a survival instinct," he said.
"We display our best assets to attract mates or to warn off predators. Like the peacock. Are you claiming to be better than millions of years of evolution?" "I'm the pinnacle," Sloane said, solemn. "Congratulations on meeting me."
"I feel so honored."
He picked up a strainer and poured the drink into a martini glass, then added the olive. It danced at the bottom of the glass, no longer threatening to become a dangerous projectile. "My siphon's still getting repaired," she said. "It's only been a day."
"Which would drive most people insane," he said.
He tossed the ice and rinsed out the shaker, then started on the old-fashioned old-fashioned with a muddler and a sugar cube in a fresh tumbler.
"I think it's nice not to rely on magic for everything," she said.
"You're in the wrong place then," he said. "Might want to go to a haven city instead." Sloane didn't know what that meant. "You ever been to one?"
"I was born in one, Arlington, Texas," he said.
"No accent, though," she said.
"I had some trouble with magic pretty early in life," he said. "Moved here as a child to learn how not to destroy things with it."
He paused with the tumbler in one hand and the jigger of whiskey in the other, his dark eyes fixed on her. She felt like he was waiting for something. And the longer she went without giving it to him, the more of a misstep she was making. But she was missing all the vocabulary for this place. The unspoken words for what a haven city was. And what it meant that he had destroyed things with magic as a child, and even what it suggested. That she could go a day without a siphon.
"Did your parents stay here?"
she said, knowing it was the wrong thing to ask, but not coming up with anything else.
"Nancy and Phil? Live in a magic hub? Perish the thought."
He spooned a cherry into the tumbler on top of the whiskey, ice, and sugar.
"No, they never came to begin with."
"Ah." She searched, desperately, for a new subject.
"Well, I'm from the middle of nowhere. High school graduating class of 23 students.
It had been a middle school class in another dimension. But he didn't need to know that.
"And now you're here in the big city," he said.
He still had that look in his eyes like he was waiting. She knew the smart thing would be to end the conversation, go back to her table, and never see him again. But she stayed sitting on the bar stool.
"Doing what, exactly?"
"I already told you," she said.
"Mayhem."
He didn't laugh. The blue glow of the olive reflected in his eyes, which in the dim bar looked almost black. She watched the blue ricochet in his irises as the olive moved in the glass. Finally, he smirked.
"I guess you did," he said. "Here's your drink." She took the old-fashioned off the bar and sipped it, then followed him back to the table, where he handed out Esther's drink and the two beers like nothing had happened. But something had. Sloane just didn't know quite what it was. Etta and Kyros were singing. The four of them were walking from the bar to the nearest hotel, where it was easier to hail a taxi. It was dark, and Esther had noted that at least half of the streetlights they passed were the old gas-burning kind. It seemed to Sloane that with the spread of magic had come a deep affinity for the past, but she wasn't sure what one had to do with the other. Maybe it was like the movie set feel of the Tankard. All their magic stories were set in old-timey fantasy worlds, or eras so ancient the magical acts were associated with old gods and angels and demons. So they reached backward to figure out how to be magical instead of forward. Esther hooked her arm around Sloane's elbow. "So that mocks," she said. "I know what you're thinking," Sloane said, "and you're off base. All I was going to say is, if you want to have a rebound fling with that hot praying mantis, you don't have to hide it from me," she said. "That's all."
"Good to know," Sloane said.
"I'd hide it from Matt, though."
"Obviously."
Esther cocked her head to the side and looked up at Sloane like she was trying to remember the title of a song. "You seem better here," she said.
"Better?" Sloane laughed. "Tell that to Evan Kowalczyk. I didn't say you were normal. Just better. Steadier."
"Well," Sloane replied, "I know how to do this. Fight the big bad, dodge the government goons. Same script, different movie." Esther nodded. She choked a little when she responded. "I don't want to do this again." Etta and Kyros had finished their song, one they had both learned in army training, apparently. They stood under the bright overhang outside the hotel, talking to a man in uniform with a whistle in his mouth.
"What if I die here?" Esther's voice was throaty. "What if my mom dies at home without ever knowing?" Sloane couldn't bear to hear the rest. She had met Esther's mother when they were both teenagers, and Esther's face had still been round as a dinner plate. Her mother had been warm, but somehow aloof, like she was living in two worlds at the same time, and each took her attention away from the other. And then, years later, after her diagnosis, she had been half the size, her head wrapped in a scarf, and still always smiling. None of their parents were the dream of what parents should be. Every one of them had given their child away. But of all of them, Esther's mother was maybe the closest, fussing over Esther's diminishing waist, always foisting cookies and tea on them even if she was in someone else's house. Sloane squeezed Esther's hand hard and hoped the pressure would steady her. She wasn't good at consoling people. That had been Albie's job. "Your mom knows everything she needs to know," she said. "That her daughter saved the world and loves her." Esther's head bobbed.
"Okay," she swallowed.
"Yeah."
A taxi pulled up to the curb. They all piled in, quieting down on the drive back to the Camel. Sloane looked out the window, but she didn't see anything they passed. All she could think about was how everything that happened now, including getting pulled into a parallel dimension, would be after Albie. Like a new era. Sloane, A.A. Some things split your life in half.
Top secret. Cordis, memorandum for the record. 2. Director, Project Delphi. From Captain Kyros Stasiak, Cordis Protective Forces. Subject, Ellsbury, Missouri.
"Dear Director, I understand your point of view regarding the destructive incident in Ellsbury, Missouri. I initially shared it myself. However, after interviewing dozens of people and observing the aftermath myself, I want to assure you that the reports were neither imagined nor exaggerated. Witnesses did indeed observe a figure fitting the description of the man Merlin saw at the site of the massacre of the First Army of Flickering. He was followed by a troop of what appeared to be reanimated corpses. Whether there was actually anything supernatural about the supposed corpses remains to be seen, but the descriptions are consistent, specific, and reliable. We are working to repair the town hall, which was obliterated, and we have offered modest reparations to the families of the dead to cover funeral costs. But what we would rather give them is an explanation of how their loved ones died and who killed them. They have begun calling him the Resurrectionist. Let us hope he can be apprehended before the nickname catches on. Sincerely, Captain Kiros Stashuk, Cordis Protective Forces.
Top Secret. Cordis Memorandum for the Record. To Director Project Delphi. From Captain Kiros Stashuk, Cordis Protective Forces. Subject, regarding Aylesbury, Missouri.
Dear Director, 2 days ago we received a report that there had been a disturbance at Rose Hill Cemetery on the north side of Chicago. The report said that huge amounts of earth had been displaced in an apparently magical fashion, exposing countless graves to the elements. The case had been tied up in local, non-magical law enforcement for a few months before they realized magic had been involved and referred it to us. We sent an officer to investigate the incident. What we discovered is that dozens of graves had been dug up, their coffins opened, and the bodies therein stolen. Upon further investigation, it seems that all of the aforementioned bodies belonged to soldiers of the First Army of Flickering. I cannot help but make a connection between the Resurrectionist's last attack in Peoria, Illinois, where he was again seen with a small army of what was described as reanimated corpses. To be specific, skin rotted, bones exposed, fingernails claw-like, some holding their own severed limbs, and this incident. The coffins were unearthed at approximately the same time as the Resurrectionist's first attack. I submit that perhaps the Resurrectionist has enacted some sick magical working that we do not presently comprehend. He has successfully raised an army from the dead. I trust you will find this as disturbing as I do. Pardon my language, but what kind of twisted son of a bitch massacres an army and then raises them from the dead to take down their former leader? I wish I had better news. Sincerely, Captain Kiros Stashuk, Cordis Protective Forces.
Chapter 24. The first time she had ever seen Matt was at the farmhouse, which is what they called the building where they had trained to defeat the Dark One. He had been holding on to the chain of the porch swing, gangly, his hair in short dreadlocks. He had told her she had a weird name and asked her how she got it. When she told him she and her brother were named after characters in the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, he had laughed, and his smile had been so wide that she liked him right away. There was something about Matt standing in the hallway holding the doorframe that reminded her of the teenager she had known. But he had stopped smiling that way a long time ago, long before they started dating. He certainly wasn't smiling now. "Nice note," he said, holding up the piece of paper Sloan had slipped under his door before they left. "Matt, we're going to meet alternate Bert. Just have to know. Taking chaperones, so don't worry. Slow and Essie." He crumpled it up and threw it at her feet. It bounced up against her shins and settled near the wall. "Well, I actually told you where I was going this time," Sloane said coolly. "That isn't the issue," Matt said. "We're supposed to be a team, Sloane." "You don't want a team," Sloane said. "You want obedience." Matt flinched like she had hit him and stepped back. She felt a twinge of regret. But she was tired of bracing herself every time she wanted to do something, say something, go somewhere. And not just here in Genetrix, but anywhere. He was a kind man, but his disapproval was paternalistic, at best, and at worst, oppressive. Wow, hey, none of this, Esther said before Matt could respond. She put herself between them, holding one hand out to Sloane and the other out to Matt. It's not like Sloane dragged me along, Matt. I agreed with her that it would be helpful, and I knew you wouldn't want to come, so... No. You knew that if you told me about it before you left, I would argue with you, Matt said, scowling. You don't just get to go behind my back because you know I disagree with you. Have I ever done that to either of you? Well, maybe if you ever wanted to do anything. Sloane, shut up, Esther snapped. Stop being such a fucking child. Heat rushed into Sloane's face. Esther pinched her nose as if forcing tension away. Sloane kept forgetting how tired Esther had looked when she dragged herself out of the river. Nothing was waiting for Sloane back on Earth except familiarity and an apartment she needed to move out of. But waiting for Esther was a dying parent. Every moment they spent here was, for her, a moment too long. You make a fair point, Esther said to Matt. Right, Sloane? You don't have to pressure her into agreeing with you, Matt said. She's not, Sloane forced herself to say. It's a fair point. Sorry. Esther sighed with obvious relief and kicked off one of her shoes so it landed somewhere in the bedroom she had claimed. The other one soon joined it, and she stood in flat feet. Her pink lipstick faded everywhere but the outline of her mouth. Her eye makeup smeared under her lower lashes. The Essie of Insta fame was gone. Okay, Matt said. Well? How was he? A dick, Sloane said. He was not a dick, Esther said. He was a mailman with a dead wife. No interest in government work or magic. So he wasn't like Bert. Matt looked triumphant. I told Esther earlier, just because someone's got the same genes as their parallel counterpart, he was a lot like Bert, actually. Sloane crossed her arms and leaned against the wall. He was listening to Neil Young. He had all these books on magical objects of legend. He talked like Bert, teared up like Bert. He had fucking gnomes in his front yard. He was Bert. But the spread of magic derailed him. How could the spread of magic derail him? Bert was fascinated by magic, Matt said. He would have loved for it to become widespread. No, Bert was fascinated by mystery, Sloane said. He liked knowing things that no one else knew, and finding out that myths were real. So once magic became this known quantity that you could control with tech and frequencies, he lost interest. She stared at her shoes, covered in dust and dirt and puddle water. He was similar enough that I lost it a little, she said. He was similar enough that I think it's possible, maybe even likely, that the Resurrectionist could be an alternate version of the Dark One. Our Dark One was just making use of magic that most of Earth didn't believe existed, Matt said. I guess it makes sense that in a world where magic is widely known to exist, he would delve deeper into what was possible. Like bring an army back from the dead. Sloane nodded. I mean, if a normal person knew how to bring someone back from death, they wouldn't build a freaking army. They would bring back loved ones, family, friends, Esther said. Sloane thought of Cameron at the community swimming pool, teaching her how to backflip into the water. There were so many things she hadn't said to him. Things she could say if she figured out how to raise the dead. Esther's voice sounded strained as she continued, as if she was thinking of her own father, lost to the Dark One, and her mother, who wouldn't be around much longer. But the Dark One isn't normal. The good news, well, the slightly better than horrible news, Sloane said, is that we do know the Dark One a little. So we're not facing a completely unknown enemy here. Like you said the other day, Matt, we've done this before. It was a better apology than the earlier one, in a way. It acknowledged that he had been right to find hope in the idea that they had experienced this already. She was remembering, only it didn't feel like memory, not really. It felt like becoming something she had already been. A pared-down Sloane, whittled to her essential elements. A clenched jaw and a clear head and a single purpose. The end of the Dark One. I know you hate the siphon, Sloane, but you have to keep working on it, Matt said. We all do. That's the next step for us here. Learn how to use magic. Because it's the best weapon we have. Never thought I'd wish I'd still had the needle stuck in my hand, Sloane said. But I'm starting to. Over the next week, Sloane grew to despise the siphon. She hated its weight, its coldness, the feeling of the strings that pulled it tight to her knuckles. It was useless and inert on her hand no matter which working she tried. Cyriel had given up on the magical breath and had attempted to teach her half a dozen small workings, each of which had the same result. Nothing. The Resurrectionist was just a specter, a legend. But the siphon was an enemy she could see and touch. The others were mastering theirs without much difficulty. Matt had a knack for moving objects without touching them. Esther had been clumsy with all wrist siphon workings. But Cyriel, in a stroke of genius, had gotten a throat siphon for her. And now Esther could mimic anyone's voice at will. Every morning, Sloane considered smashing the siphon with one of the books at her bedside. The only thing that stopped her was fear of the Resurrectionist and the thought of the drain. Sloane considered going back to the tankard to see Mox again, but decided against it. Instead, she found other ways to occupy herself. She took Kyros running along the lakefront despite the frosty air. She read the stack of books she had found in her room. She even managed to drag Esther to the Art Institute, where there was now an entire wing dedicated to art workings. She had wandered for hours through an exhibit of photographs that turned into three-dimensional scenes when you drew close, to make you feel like you were walking around inside them. She was beginning to understand the unrealists. How could you trust reality when reality was so easily manipulated? The only upside to the constant siphon frustration was how tiring it was. The heavy sleep kept her clear of the worst of her nightmares, though nothing could entirely protect her from them. More often than not, she dreamed about Albie, about chasing him through empty streets or up and down staircases. In one vivid dream, he ran out into traffic on the interstate and got crushed between two semis heading straight toward each other. The whole scene had erupted into flames. When Sloane woke up from those dreams, she gave up on going back to sleep and tried to soothe herself by reading. The three of them had gathered all the books left in their rooms and piled them in the hallway, making a little library. Sloane kept the manifestation of impossible wants, a new theory of magic, for herself. But she also picked up a collection of poetry from Matt's room and a history text from Esther's. The history book covered the period after the end of World War II, the establishment of the Iron Curtain, and a Cold War Sloane both did and didn't recognize. She waited for the development of satellite technology, the space race, but it didn't come. In its place, there was technology to plunge deeper underwater, to hear farther across the so far channel, the level of the ocean at which sound traveled fastest, to place hydrophones deeper in the ocean without losing their efficacy. And all this resulted, of course, in the Tenebris incident, an accident of underwater missile testing that had spread magic throughout the world. Sloane was sitting in the hallway one morning, the book in her lap, and a half-empty cup of coffee next to her, when she heard a soft ding, the sound of the elevator arriving. Nero exited, his hands in his pocket, one thumb covered in the chrome of his siphon. His hair was combed back from his forehead, revealing lines she hadn't noticed before. She wondered, for the first time, how old he was. "Yes," she said to him as he came closer. "I have been alerted of your wandering the halls every single night this week," Nero said to her. "I finally came to find out if you were sleepwalking." "So whatever magical alarm you've rigged, it's on my room," Sloane said. "Are you watching me sleep, Creepmaster 2000? "Creep what?" Nero crouched next to her, his elbows on his knees. "No, I am not watching you sleep. I am simply made aware that someone has exited their living space." "I have insomnia," Sloane said. "Always?" "Since my brother was murdered by a world-destroying lord of evil," Sloane said. "I usually take medication for it, but I left it at home." Nero tilted his head as he looked at her. "Did it not occur to you that we also make medicine on Genetrix?" Sloane laughed a little. "I guess it hadn't." "Do you guys have benzodiazepines?" "Like Valium?" Nero said. "I guess that would work," she said. "I will request some for you," Nero said. "I know how frustrating it is not to get enough sleep on a regular basis." Sloane hadn't realized it would be that simple. "Well, thanks." "Of course." Nero nudged her book so he could see what was on the cover. It was a sketch of the baleen whale Kyros had mentioned, adrift in the clouds above Challenger Deep. "History," Nero said. "I suppose that makes it easier to sleep." "You don't like history?" "Not particularly, no," Nero shrugged. "On a grand scale, perhaps, the birth of the world, the first living organisms, the beginning of humanity. But the details of squabbling between nations, that's my land, no, it's mine, let's kill each other over it. No, that does not interest me." "Without those little squabbles, you wouldn't have magic," Sloane said. "There wouldn't have been a ballistic missile to accidentally fire into the Mariana Trench." "And magic for magic's sake, that's such a good thing?" "No," Sloane said. "But don't you like magic? You work here, after all." "Sometimes I like it," he said. "It's given me knowledge of the universe beyond anything my ancestors would have dreamed. But that knowledge is never enough to prevent catastrophe, it seems." "It's not your responsibility to stop all bad things from happening." "Only some things, I know." He smiled a little. "But I bear the weight of them." She wondered if he was thinking of his sister, lured into the resurrectionist's clutches. The horror of her death, her body suspended above the camel, stiff and cold. Sometimes Sloane thought of Cameron that way too, lying dead in his casket, dusted with powder from the mortician that made him look plastic, like a doll. She had been young when he joined the fight against the Dark One. Too young to stop him, probably, but she hadn't even tried. "I understand that, I think," she said. "I didn't mean to interrupt your reading with my moroseness," Nero said. "I hear that your siphon efforts have been considerable, but fruitless." Nero acknowledged that with a nod. "There's a book that may help you to understand more about magical theory. It's called The Manifestation of Impossible Wants." "Yeah, I read that one," she said. Maybe she was flattering herself, but she thought he looked a little impressed. "Magic is all about desire, not just intent, blah, blah. Didn't do me much good. You can't make yourself want something." Nero cocked his head to the side again. "Can't you?" She had never considered that before. She had lived half her life wanting only one thing: to save the world, and the other half wanting to be left alone, which was almost the same thing as wanting nothing at all. She didn't know what it was like to desire something between those two extremes, She wasn't sure she was even capable of it.
I don't know, she said.
Well, then, that's the central question, Nero said. You will never be able to do magic unless you find a way to want to. He got to his feet with a groan, his knees creaking. I'm a little too old to sit on the floor, I'm afraid. I'll talk to a doctor about your medicine once the world is awake. Thanks again, she said. Nero walked down the hallway, humming. Chapter 25. Sloane stopped on the corner and looked up, trying to see the corkscrew spire on top of the tallest building in Genetrix's Chicago, Warner Tower. It was the one with two faces, one flat, the other un-